The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Thanks everyone for coming this evening. Our speaker tonight is Ajahn Kunadama, who was born in Toronto and began studying Buddhism under the direction of Kema Ananda at what was then the Arrow River Community Center near Thunder Bay. In 1990, he went to Thailand and received the higher ordination in 1992 at Wat Phananashat, and that's in the Ajahn Chah tradition. And many people are familiar with Ajahn Chah's writing and some of the teachers who have worked with Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Kunadama returned to Arrow River in 1995 and now is the head monk there at a wonderful hermitage that a number of people here have practiced at. And he also frequently leads retreats at the Insight Meditation Center in Barrie. And Arrow River has a wonderful website, and I often check it out because Ajahn has a bhikkhu blog in which he comments on not only matters of Buddhist practice, but also current events, and it's quite delightful. So tonight he will be speaking on the path of transcendence, and this is December 10th, 2006. So thank you, Ajahn.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. We all start at some point practicing meditation, practicing the Dhamma for various reasons, but usually it's some intuitive or heartfelt appreciation of First Noble Truths. In other words, one experiences the degree of suffering in this life as an issue, something to be dealt with, rather than escaped or avoided, denied. One realizes the First Noble Truth of the Buddha. There is dukkha. This existence as a human being, as the Buddha said, is marked by birth, sickness, old age, and death. Separation from the desired, attachment to the undesired, grief, lamentation, pain, and despair. Of course, that isn't the whole of existence. There is pleasurable moments, pleasurable experience in the human realm. But beings do confront this situation, sometimes called the existential dilemma, you know, being between the twin chasms of birth and death. As a problem to be faced, as a dilemma. And in individual cases, we also experience degrees of suffering from loss, and everyone's story is different, from loss or from unfulfilled desire. Various kinds of mental anguish. and we can experience a great deal of suffering just due to our mind states, various kinds of undesired mind states, which in modern parlance we call anxiety, depression, these states of mind that cause suffering. So beings are drawn to practicing the Dhamma as a method of confronting and dealing with their suffering. And sometimes the approach to Dhamma practice is based on ideas like relieving stress, getting over anxiety, sorting out our personal neuroses. And these are all goals and ends that meditation can help with. And this is a positive improvement and evolution of the life and the being, to relieve stress, anxiety, overcome fear and depression, to sort out and clarify the mind and untangle the various knots, karmic knots of neurosis. And these are all valid goals, but they're partial goals. And if the meditator stops there, is moved only so far, it's a very partial practice. And it may even be argued that many of these partial goals are better met by other means than meditation. The Buddha the Buddha's teaching is summarized in his Four Noble Truths. This is the essence of the whole of the Buddha's teaching, is contained in these Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. It's the one that is intuitively obvious to people who are not in a state of denial. You can see that, that there is this existential dilemma. The second noble truth is the Buddha's analysis of the root of the problem, speaking about the cause of suffering as desire, tanha, craving. And the fourth noble truth, the last one, is the path, and it's a detailed explication of the ways and means. But one I wish to focus on this evening in my Desana is the third noble truth, which is the truth of the end of suffering, the truth of Nirodha, Dukkha Nirodha, the extinguishment of suffering, the final end of suffering. And it's quite a radical promise. It's not a promise of relief or alleviation. It's a promise of complete extinguishment of suffering. And in the formula of the third noble truth as given in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is the Buddha's first sutta, he doesn't really go into detail at that point. He just says Third Noble Truth is the end of suffering, which can be realized whenever craving is eliminated. But elsewhere in the suttas, he does talk about the goal of the path. Third Noble Truth is synonymous with nibbana, or nirvana in Sanskrit, which is more familiar in English usage. And this is a very central element in the whole totality of the Buddhist teaching. It's important not to lose sight of this is the goal of the path. And if it's not, if nibbana is not understood as the goal of the path, then the path is a very incomplete one. It's a very shallow one. It doesn't lead out from suffering. Of course, it becomes then the natural question to ask, what is nibbana? And this is a very difficult question because it's intrinsically unanswerable. This is the unconditioned element. And because it's unconditioned, asankata, it's not susceptible to approach with the mind, with the conventional samsaric mind. It's not susceptible to reason or analysis. And even for one who has realized that, it's not capable of explanation. In the first place, it's significant that in that first sutta, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha said that the truth of suffering is to be understood. But the truth of ending of suffering, he used a different verb in Pali, patisamvedi, which could be taken to mean penetrated or experienced. So nibbana cannot be understood, but it can be penetrated or experienced. It is within the potential of human beings to experience the unconditioned. But as long as one is using the tools of the conditioned realm, it cannot be grasped. In another place, the Buddha was involved in a discussion with a wandering yogi in India who asked him the question, which was one of the stock philosophical questions of India. He asked him, what is the fate of a Tathagata after death? Tathagata is a name for a realized being. An enlightened one. And what is the fate of a Tathagata after death? It was one of the sort of standard philosophical questions of the time. And the form he asked the question was, does a Tathagata exist after death? And the Buddha said, no, that does not fit the case. So this led the fellow to assume, well, the Buddha is a nihilist. So he then asked the question, oh, then does a Buddha cease to exist at death? And the Buddha said, no, that does not fit the case. So then he asked him two additional questions. Does the Tathagata both exist and not exist? And does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist? And the Buddha answered, no, that does not fit the case to both of these. Like many of the Buddha's teachings, this has a very specific cultural connection that we can miss if we're not aware of it. The Buddha was deliberately using the four-poled logic of the formal Indian logic system. Now, in the West, our logic is based on, our formal logic is based on the Greeks, and particularly Aristotle, and it's based on a binary logic, a two-pole logic, and we have the law of the excluded middle, either A or not A, and it excludes the middle. The Indians had a very sophisticated and mature, robust system of formal logic already by the Buddha's time, but it was independently derived in India, and it was based on a four-pole system. It did not have a law of excluded middle. And in our logical shorthand, we would say that the four poles were A, not A, both A and not A, neither A nor not A. So Buddha was very specifically referring to this four-pole logic and denying that Nibbana fit in any category. And the state of the Tathagata after death is Nibbana. So then this led the fellow to be confused, because now, okay, this is outside of any kind of reason. What are you talking about? You know, so then, you know, I don't understand. And the Buddha said, well, it's as if we had a fire, and the fire went out, and someone asked, where did the fire go? Did it go east? Did it go west? Did it go north? Did it go south? And the Buddha said, obviously, these questions are wrong and they do not fit the case. So Nibbana is, by the Buddha is saying in a very elaborate and formal way in this sutta, that Nibbana is ineffable, which means inexpressible. It cannot be explained. There's also a more homey kind of a simile given somewhere else about the tortoise and the fish, who were friends, and living in a pond, and the tortoise one day was gone. The fish couldn't find his friend. And then the next day he comes back, the tortoise comes back, and the fish says, where were you? And the tortoise says, I was crawling around on dry land. So the fish says, oh, dry land, I never heard of that. Is it, what's it like? Is it nice and wet? Can you swim about? the fish was absolutely could not conceive of dry land. There's a third case to make this point, is a more modern metaphor about inexpressibility of experience. There's a little book that was written at the end of the 19th century as a kind of a mathematical game. It's called Flatland. If anyone's ever seen this book, it's about a world of two dimensions. All the beings in this world that just have two dimensions, and they slide around on two dimensions. And someone from the third dimension discovers this world, and he picks one of these beings up, and so then this being is exposed to the third dimension. And then when he returns to his world, he tries to explain to his friends. Now he's had this amazing revelation of the third dimension. So he knows what the third dimension is, but there's no way he can explain it to his friends. You know, he's trying to say there's this other direction that we never knew about before. And they say, well, where is it? Is it this way? Is it that way? Is it this way? Is it that way? They can't leave the plane of their two dimensions. So there's no way they can imagine the third dimension. So the experience of Nibbana is not to be put into any categories of conditioned realm. You know, everything in this sensory samsaric existence is conditioned. It's subject to the laws of cause and effect. And one of the names for the Nibbana, that's probably the most often used in the suttas, is asankata, unconditioned. There's a sutta where the Buddha says, there is, O monks, an unconditioned, an unborn, an undying. If there were not an unconditioned, an unborn, and undying, then there would be no escape from the conditioned, the born, and the dying. But since there is an unconditioned, an unborn, and undying, there is an escape from the born, the conditioned, the dying. Mm-hmm. So this is why we can, the title of the talk is The Path of Transcendence. Because what I'm trying to express is the idea that the Buddhist path is given to us by the Buddha as a path of transcendence from this conditioned plane of reality. For relinquishment, for release, for escape. And these are the words that he uses. It is for relinquishment, transcendence, escape. He uses the word also to refer to the unconditioned Lokuttara, which means beyond beyond this realm. Super mundane is usually translated as. And it, loka is the world. Loka means the world, and uttara means beyond. So it means beyond the world. And the world, the samsaric world in Buddhist cosmology is very broad. And we have this sense desire realm that we live in. In the Buddhist cosmology, extends from the most horrific hell states to the most sublime heavenly states, and includes all the various human, animal, ghostly realms in between. And these are all, and then beyond that, there are the fine material realms and the immaterial realms. But all of these are considered bound within samsara, subject to conditions. There is no final resolution possible within samsara. All it is an endless turning of the kaleidoscope, and new patterns, new mandalas appearing. And we're born again and again into different forms. And in each moment of samsaric existence, the mind is seeking fulfillment, seeking completion by taking objects. And it's the intrinsic nature of consciousness to be hungry for objects. And we can see this in meditation. You can watch, this is one thing that becomes clear with meditative practice fairly soon, is the hunger of mind to take objects. And this is the whole experience of getting the mind peaceful, and then distractions arise. The mind is craving to feed itself with objects. And this goes on continually. And the Buddha, seeking a way out of this samsaric dilemma, the first glimmering he had of the right path is a story of him remembering a time when he was a boy and he spontaneously went into jhana, sitting under a rose apple tree, and jhana being a deep state of meditation. And he realized that was heading in the right direction. And the reason for this is jhana itself is still, it's a very deep state of meditation, very still, very peaceful, but it is still bound within samsara. But it's said to have the taste of nibbana. It's tending in that direction. What happens with jhana is that the mind is still satiating itself with objects, but it's very still. It takes a single object and rests there. But it and so it experiences some oceanic peace. But there's still a taking of objects, and it's still considered a conditioned existence. So nibbana is something else. Although jhana has the taste of nibbana, nibbana is something else again. One of the best keys or I've come across to explaining or understanding what it might be, might point to, the concept might point to, is found in Vasuddhimagga, where it's speaking about the mind states leading up to and into liberation or awakening. And it says, and then the mind does that which it has never done since beginningless time, and alights upon non-occurrence. It alights upon non-occurrence. So the real trick is the mind simply stops doing that. And it simply stops this inveterate habit of satiating itself, attempting to satiate itself with objects. Now, this is the intrinsic samsaric project. Consciousness seeking to complete itself by taking an object. And if it just, and all the movement to the transcendental or to the unconditioned represents in these terms is simply stop doing that. And it's kind of a jump sideways. And there's no movement of the mind towards an object. So if this element of nibbana or the unconditioned is left out of Buddhism, then what's left is a very shallow, partial teaching, and it becomes equivalent to either Stoicism or existentialism. And instead of a path of transcendence, it can become a path of reconciliation, of just getting used to samsara, adapting to samsara. Whereas the Buddha was quite explicit about relinquishment, transcendence, escape, an end of suffering, not a reconciliation with suffering or an acceptance of suffering. Of course, the difficulty in this is talking about nibbana, and we say that it can't be explained, it can't be understood, don't try and figure it out, but it's something worth going for. you know, so something worth devoting your life to finding, it becomes a very abstract goal for people. On one hand, this is something that I really appreciate about Buddhism, and particularly the Theravada form of Buddhism, is that the expression of the unconditioned is very pure. You know, all religions have some concept of the transcendental, that which is beyond this realm. And often they try and explain it or detail it. But what is Theravada is very pure in the sense of not doing that. You know, the Buddha himself rarely spoke about Nibbana, and if you go through all the voluminous pages of the suttas, you'll find references to Nibbana here and there, but it's not a major topic of discussion, because he deliberately, you know, didn't want to mislead people. And most of the mentions of Nibbana fall into one of two categories. They're either negative, telling us what Nibbana is not. It's not born, it's not dying, it's not a state of existence, it's not a state of non-existence. It's telling us negatives. Or there's poetic allusions, metaphors, speaking of it as the supreme bliss, or in very metaphorical terms, such as the clear forest pool. He spoke about the mind that had attained Nibbana as being like a clear pool of water. And there's one sutta where he goes through different possible states of rebirth in a metaphorical way, in a series of similes. And he says, just as if there were a wanderer, tired, weary, dusty with the road, thirsty, coming to the end of a long road, and he stumbles into a pit of blazing fire and embers. That would be like rebirth into hell. And if at the end of the road this dusty, weary traveler stumbles into a pit full of excrement, that would be like birth into the ghost realm. That's birth in the animal realm. If he comes to a tree in a clearing, and the tree is mottled shade, half the leaves are missing, and the ground is rough and uneven, and he sits there to take a rest, that's like the ghost realm. And if he comes to a tree in a clearing with thick, deep foliage, and the ground is soft and level, and he takes his rest there, that's like rebirth in the human realm. And if he comes at the end of his path to a pavilion, shaded, comfortable, with a couch well laid out, with pillows for the head and feet, and he lays in there, that's like the heaven realm. But even there, he doesn't get any water. This is not mentioned. But if he comes at the end of his path to a clear forest pool where he can bathe and drink to his contentment and be quenched, this is like Nibbana. And this is to be taken as a simile. It's not to be grasped at that Nibbana is some kind of state of post-mortem paradise. And there's always the tendency in the human mind to fall into wrong views in one of two directions, either towards eternalism or annihilationism. Those are the two classical false views. And in the history of Buddhism, there's been movements towards both directions. And there's some that take passages like that and fall into an eternalist view. And there's also, but then there's also passages that speak of Nibbana as the utter extinction without remainder of the khandhas. And people seize on those passages and fall into annihilationism. But the reality is, of Nibbana cannot really be understood or expressed. It's neither existence nor non-existence, nor both nor neither. So there's a certain purity in keeping it like that, but there's, as I say, there's the difficulty of having it so abstract as a goal, of being unknown and even unimaginable. And it becomes, and this is a very important point, it becomes essentially a matter of faith. And this is the one point in the whole of the Buddha's teaching that really must be taken on faith. There is no way to convince oneself by reason of the reality of Nibbana. It's possible to be experienced, and then once it's experienced, it's no longer a matter of faith. But before it's experienced, it must be taken on faith. And if there's no faith in Third Noble Truth, then the motivation for the path is very weak, and there's no impetus to push through the difficulties. I'll give you a simile from my own experience. When I was in Thailand, there was one place I stayed at where there were these little gullies with water running through, little creeks that I had to cross every day to get to the meal. And normally the water would be ankle deep. But in the monsoon season, after rain, the water could be up to your waist or higher. And it was a very strong current. And crossing it would be very difficult some days. And about a third of the way across, I could hold on to branches from the near bank. And when I got two-thirds of the way across, I could grasp branches on the far shore and keep my balance. But there were two or three steps in the middle that were quite scary. When I lost the support of the near shore and hadn't yet grasped the far shore, and imagine how psychologically difficult it would be if you couldn't even see the far shore and didn't really even have faith that there was a far shore to get to. It would be very difficult to take those steps. So we often use that simile, and it often comes up in the Buddhist discourse of crossing to the far shore. And there has to be a faith in the being that there is a far shore to cross to, or you'll continually cling to the branches of the near shore, and always fall back to seeking solace in the sense realm, and retreat into the diversions and distractions of the sensory apparatus, rather than letting them go. And this is really what's meant by relinquishment and renunciation, is being able to abandon the support of the near shore, which is the sense realm and the solace and pleasure of sense pleasure, and taking those steps, which are really steps into the abyss, into the void, and unknown. Some of you may have seen some of the imagery of the tarot cards, you know, and the tarot card of the fool is very, very much this this idea. The imagery is of a kind of a harlequin figure, a raggedy clown figure, stepping out over a cliff. In some versions, he's looking at a butterfly. He's distracted by a butterfly. But in others, he's just blindly stepping over the edge of a cliff. You know, and the fool is the zero card. And it's really the card of enlightenment and transcendence, the card of sunyata, voidness. And there has to be that spirit of the fool stepping out into the abyss without with this, the great courage of a fool. Only the fool has this the great courage. We often see stories in, and I've come across stories in different versions in Theravada, in Zen, and in Tibetan Buddhism. The story of the simple shepherd or peasant who has no illiterate, has no learning, but he has a great heartfelt faith, and he's given a few words of instruction, almost dismissively by the master, just to get rid of him. You know, don't this peasant hanging around. Okay, go watch your breath at the nose tip. Okay, and he goes away and follows this instruction and attains to all kinds of states and samadhi and enlightenment very quickly. Whereas the scholar who wants to analyze everything and studied Abhidhamma for 20 years and knows the scriptures inside and out and can quote Nagarjuna and Ashvaghosa and all the rest of them, he gets nowhere. And this is the power of faith. The simplicity of just going with it, you know, just taking those steps, just letting go of the branches and taking those steps. And then it is possible to have a realization and awakening. And you don't need to rely on faith after experience, after realization. But there is that tricky bit of letting go of the near shore. So I'll stop at this point and we can have, I'll answer some questions. I don't know if there is really a way, and people have to kind of find it themselves. And unfortunately for most of us, probably for everyone in this room, the way of the simple peasant is closed long ago. You know, we're overly stuffed with concepts as it is. It's always good to try and move to simplicity in practice. One thing I like to say sometimes when I'm teaching meditation is to tell people that the highest meditation, the best, the perfect meditation is to sit there and do nothing at all. But because that is so supremely difficult, we give you minimal things to do to kind of approach nothing, such as watch your breath. You know, this is not quite doing nothing, but it's close. You know? Often people tend to make practice way too complicated. And really is the simplicity is a supreme vehicle. In fact, another way of saying it is to look at the whole spiritual path as a progress of simplification and purification. You know, this is a point I didn't really get into in the talk, but it's actually an important point, so I'll mention it now too, is when we talk about the goal of the path and attaining nibbana and so on, that's a little bit misleading language too, because it can be taken and become a kind of goal-oriented project. You know? And really there's nothing to attain, nowhere to go. It's actually all there right now. What the project really is, the progress in the path, is just removing the blinkers that prevent us from seeing it. So it's a process of simplifying the mind, removing defilements, removing obscurations and views, and just allowing the natural state of mind to express itself. So thinking of it as something outside or additional is very misleading. Thinking of it as something that's there all the time, but we just have to learn how to notice it, that's closer. Yes?
I have a sort of two-part question that turns around the definitions, I think. First of all, is nibbana a permanent state, or do you go in and out of nibbana? And the real question I was wondering about is, can you tell the difference between nibbana and samadhi?
Yeah. Well, the experience, I take your first part of the question and just to technically clarify it, is the experience of nibbana is something that one goes in and out of. Nibbana itself is not subject to impermanence, but there are degrees of realization of nibbana. We talk in Theravada, we have the four stages of enlightenment. And stream entry, the first stage, is just a barest glimpse. It's the slightest flash of experience of nibbana, but that's enough to change the being in the depth permanently forever. Because at that point, then faith becomes perfect, because there's no possibility of doubt anymore. You know, once the unconditioned has been glimpsed, then the whole picture is clarified in a new way. And then the other stages are increasing penetration, and until the arahant can rest in nibbana. But then, even for the arahant, I think it's a matter of some debate even within the tradition whether you could say he's in nibbana constantly. While in the light, but then at death, with the relinquishment of the khandhas are dissolved, then it becomes identical to nibbana, and there's no movement from that point. So what was your second point of question?
Contrasting.
Oh, with the samadhi and nibbana. They are different, and it's possible it is possible to be mistaken, you know, and there are all kinds of cases, very common in in both in the literature and in real life experience of stories from Thailand and elsewhere of people who believe they have attained and haven't. You know, it's a very tricky issue. The advice that's often given is to examine the mind afterwards for purification of the fetters. Because jhana has only the quality of suppressing the fetters, but nibbana breaks them. So then, and there's a whole, it would take too long to go into everything in detail, but there's a whole, there's ten fetters, and there's a whole scheme of which ones are broken at which stage of enlightenment. So for just to say, stream entry breaks right in ritual clinging, personality view, and skeptical doubt. Those are eliminated with stream entry, because it's essentially a purification of view. Now one understands the difference between conditioned and unconditioned, and view is purified. So if someone thinks they've attained stream entry, the teacher, unless the teacher has great penetration of mind like a Buddha, a great Arahant, and can read minds, he won't know for sure if the fellow's really done it. So he will probably advise him, examine your mind often for those fetters and see if there's a trace of those fetters remaining, and decide for yourself if there is or isn't. Yes.
I like everyone in this room, I would, of course, like to think from that. I read about the Buddha, and during that period, it seemed like people were reaching their Buddha right in the...
Yeah.
And when I think about that as, oh, those are the good old days. Things are happening now.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what the teachings are about why that's so.
Yeah, there's a specific reason for that. At the time when the Buddha came into being, there were many other beings who had great spiritual potential, who had a great karmic merit to be born into the presence of a Buddha. And they were on the edge of being enlightened. And so they became enlightened and they ceased to take rebirth. And then in the next generation, the ones who had just missed, they got enlightened. And so there's a teaching that there's a continuous decline in spiritual potential. So by now, you know, 2,500 years later, it's just a few of us losers are hanging around. It's much more difficult, you know, and it gets... So this should be taken as an incentive for urgency, because things are just going to get more difficult next time. You know, so don't rest on the idea, well, next time I'll do better next lifetime. Conditions are going to get more difficult.
Well, in your comment about the simplicity or the fool, I appreciated that analogy too. My experience has been that when I'm reading all these books, I'm really probably not searching for an answer. I'm just enjoying the search.
Yeah.
And it might just be a better way of exercising the mind instead of maybe hanging out at Mall of America or smoking pot or something, you know.
Yeah.
It's probably just a healthier, you know, it's like the three gunas. Yeah. It's just a mode of goodness.
Yeah.
What got you to go into a monastery?
Yeah.
And actually lead, you know, we're I'm playing with it, you actually doing it.
Well, I had been practicing for a long time before I became a monk. It wasn't a sudden decision. I'd been practicing as a layperson for 10 years by the time I became a monk. And I realized there was some element missing for me, in the practice as a layperson of relinquishment, I found it very difficult to relinquish in the depth, because I could do long retreats and I could practice very rigorously, but there was always the kind of idea somewhere in the back of my mind that, you know, on such and such a date I'm coming out of retreat, you know, and then it's party time. And this is always somewhere in the back of the mind, is this sort of, you know, the alternative, and just the idea of ordaining, just the act of ordaining, and this kind of relinquishment, it does free up the mind in the depth quite a bit. I don't know if it would work for everybody. You know, some people ordain and struggle with it and end up disrobing. Other people seem to have the discipline to practice as lay people and attain states. But there is something about ordaining as a vehicle of relinquishment that I found very valuable. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you explained it very clearly to me. But the only thing that I find is very interesting in your explanation is that you start out with the first of the truth, which is suffering, everybody understands that.
Yeah. Okay,
why we suffer, because that's the reason.
Yeah.
In practice, the second cause is really important, because everybody is going through something, but I don't know why.
Yeah.
And in the teaching, it says there are three poisons, which is greed, anger, and delusion.
Yeah. Yes.
And the path to me is the most important.
Yes. Yes.
And if you practice all of that, it's just almost automatic. You will end suffering.
Yeah.
Whether you call it Nirvana, or you call it heaven,
yeah.
Other religion call it pure land, other religion call it heaven.
Yeah.
In Buddhism, we call it Nirvana. But when you explain, if the goal is Nirvana,
yeah.
In order to go through pain, you practice.
Yeah.
Practicing is painful.
Yes.
But you don't know why.
Yeah.
I mean, if you explain to Dharma as to why, I don't care to go there anyway. Even though I have to have faith, but how can I have that strong faith in order to take the first step to practice Buddhism?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever you explain, still people don't understand it. But if you say
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
So when I'm talking about, if people ask me why I practice Buddhism, and maybe I don't say that because of faith, I practice Buddhism. First of all, I came from a family who practiced Buddhism. And some of you here are Americans. I don't think maybe two-thirds of you, you don't come from a family who are Buddhist, but they are. So you're talking about faith. It's really difficult to convince people to practice Buddhist teachings. So I think the order you put about the four foundations of the four of the truths, I can take the third one as a goal. But for the ordinary people like myself, I take the second one as a goal because I know why I suffer. And I want to end suffering. That's why I take the fourth one. Is the main practice, so I just go on. I don't do it because of faith.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to, you know, I can't cover everything in one talk, so I wanted to do this talk on Third Noble Truth. I have on other times, so I've spoken on Second Noble Truth. What I wanted to express, and the reason I approached it the way I did, was because I think sometimes that's a missing element in people's practice, and that if they don't orient themselves towards the complete ending of suffering, then they always come up short. You know, the goal. As you say, the more you relinquish suffering, the more you relinquish craving, the less suffering you have. But that's still short of a total escape from suffering. And that is not just a matter of degrees. There's a whole deep relinquishment in the psyche that needs to occur, and it does take the element of faith. As you know, the Buddha gave faith as one of the five faculties necessary for liberation, and it's one that's very critical. And I think that's the point of practice at which it really applies, is to have faith in the possibility of an unconditioned. Yes.
How do you increase that pain?
That's a difficult question, because it's not something you can, you know, artificially force on yourself. It can be nourished, encouraged. One particular vehicle for rousing faith is practice of Buddha Nusati, contemplation of the Buddha, contemplation of the qualities of the Buddha. And for many people, the whole devotional side of practice, chanting and Buddha images, puja, that helps to nourish faith. And to a large degree, the right kind of study can help faith too. You know, reading the words of the Buddha, and immersing yourself in, particularly in the primary sources, reading the suttas, you know, just becoming really immersed in that ambiance of the language and the way of thought of the enlightened ones is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. using the natural world. It was also like your story about crossing the river.
Yeah.
Half English.
Yeah. Yeah, there's all kinds of Dhamma teachings in the natural world, but I think for on this particular point, on Third Noble Truth, it's not really the natural world, because the natural world is all samsara, and there's a lot to teach about First and Second Noble Truth. But I don't think you find much to point you to Third Noble Truth in the natural world. Yes.
In taking your story of crossing, so you start out the day and the river is low and you're able to navigate the stones, and then during the day, as you're crossing, the river rises.
Yeah.
And there's no hold, there's not the near bank and the far bank.
Yeah.
And I find that a lot in the day, that I can start out the day with that easy grace.
Yeah. Yeah.
How would we, in the midst of the rising water and no near or far bank, hold on to the middle of our true day? What is the way to advance the practice?
You have to keep trying to find that still place. You know, you can rely on. Once you've got some practice established, you can rely on the experience of stillness, you know, which as the Buddha experienced, remembering his experience under the rose apple tree, there's that stillness of the samadhi of the mind has the taste of nibbana. So it's an encouragement to, that it's at least a postcard from the far shore. You know? So you rely on that stillness and, try and find even moments of that stillness to give you strength to keep going.
Even in the midst of the rising water?
Yes, yeah. Even if you just rely on the memory of stillness, that is possible to be still. I'm not still right now, but it is possible. Naturally, more and more, as you get a greater understanding of voidness.
Can you repeat the question for the larger?
The question was what? Could you comment about overcoming the fear of death? That really comes about more and more as you get some experience and understanding of voidness and anatta, and not clinging to the sense of self, because the fear of death is a fear of loss or change or destruction, annihilation of the self. And if the self is not held onto or believed as a concept any longer, then there's no fear of death. Becomes completely eradicated. If there's a complete understanding of not self, there's no fear of death. There's no room for that. It also helps to become familiar with the idea of death. So there's maranasati, which is meditation on death. Contemplating just becoming very familiar and intimate with the idea of your own impermanence, that which is born will die, and know that. There's also one other practice is to meditate into the sleep states, watching the mind go to sleep, because the states of mind that occur falling into sleep parallel exactly the dying process. And the faculties are lost as you fall asleep in the same order, the same sequence as when you die. So that you lose your external senses, you lose your sense of rationality. All these things fall away, and you can maintain, it is possible to maintain a thread of consciousness right into the dream state. Yes?
Do you think that you have to kind of be in a certain state to be ready to even approach the relinquishment? In other words, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, I definitely, where you were talking about stage one folks, you know. And my sense is that if I were to myself in a monastery wouldn't do much good because it's so far away from my abilities where I am right now.
Yeah.
Not even so much a matter of faith, but as a matter of just, abilities to quiet the mind and so on and so forth. So I'm just wondering if something happens as kind of a natural progression. I mean, I can feel a progression in myself for me. Years ago.
Yeah.
But, like I say, I wouldn't imagine that if I went into a monastery, I probably could sit there a long time. I'm just wondering whether there's some natural progression.
Yes, well, it's not, ordination isn't a magic bullet. I mean, that's a disappointment some people have. They ordain and think their minds are going to be pure the next day, you know, and it's, it's a tool. It's a skillful means. It's just another means to an end. You can continue to work on simplicity and relinquishment and tranquility in the lay life. You know? But it is possible to keep working at it and moving towards greater simplicity, greater tranquility, greater relinquishment. It may be that ordination is the vehicle for the real hard cases. People that are real, real stuck. Maybe they need it.
Maybe the time for us to conclude the formal part of the evening, but Ajahn will be staying around for some questions, and we have some tea and some refreshments if people are able to stay.